Welcome back to the Athenaeum Review podcast. We're talking today with Dr. Mark Roseman, the author of Lives Reclaimed, a story of rescue and resistance in Nazi Germany. You mentioned a moment ago of Hitler's extraordinarily violent language. It struck me that, the contrast to the euphemism in this document, it's so, the sense of euphemism, I'm not sure if this is exactly what you're saying, but I can't help but wonder, what's the motivation to be so is it some residual sense of propriety or conscience or guilt, unacknowledged guilt, knowing that we can't, they're saying we can't write down exactly what we're talking about because then we would be face to face with how evil it is, or I guess my question is what's the simplest way to explain why it's so euphemistic, this language?
It's not necessary. I mean, people often say unacknowledged guilt, and that may be there, but I don't think it's necessary, because I think one of the even those who are the sort of advocates recognize that they're crossing normal human lines. And so, and they know that it's going to be misunderstood, and they know that others are not going to accept this, and they know that the enemy can exploit it.
Yeah.
So even those who've been persuaded that these steps are necessary see themselves as having to carry the burden of discounting their normal inhibitions to accomplish this necessary task.
Right. Right.
And so that then implies that in anything that will be facing the outside world, you should be using anodyne language. So it may imply a bad conscience, but it doesn't need to.
Okay, yeah. I guess now that you mention it, I guess bureaucracies of all kinds, even very ordinary bureaucracies, use euphemisms in all in all kinds of ways to describe everything. But that makes a lot of sense. I also, after your lecture this morning, talking about perpetrators and the way that perpetrators were perceived, and the over the recent decades of historiography, the sense of perpetrators as, or sorry, the sense of the mere functionaries has moved away and been somewhat replaced by this recognition of perpetrators as having agency and will and choice and so forth. Something that was very interesting to me in some of your writing, I think, was that the turmoil of the 1920s, or I guess from the end of World War I onward, had a very significant effect on many of those perpetrators in terms of the people that they became. I guess it would it be right to say that if we looked at their biographies up through the beginning of the First World War, that we wouldn't find what they became, or that a lot of what they became took shape over the 1920s and 30s.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, of course, I mean, many of the characters that we're talking about, the Heydrichs, the Himmlers, they were actually born between 1900 and 1910.
Right.
So that means that they're sort of have their education in the teens.
Right.
They experience the First World War and defeat at home. Himmler's just old enough to be called up, but he doesn't actually see action. The others are often younger.
Right.
They're students in the 20s, so their ideas take shape.
Okay.
Really in the 20s, I mean, this is not my work. This is the work of others.
Right.
But certainly, I mean, I think absolutely decisive for the evolution of many political identities is the defeat in 1918. And then the Versailles Treaty, not so much because of the things that we classically know about the loss of territory and so on, but the sort of loss of honor and this feeling that there was a sort of double standard, that Germany was being held accountable for things that also applied elsewhere, or, and that the treaty makers were talking a language of sort of justice and international relations, while England and France happily expanded their empire, right, right, and et cetera, et cetera. So there's a new kind of right-wing radicalism in the 1920s, for sure, that that mobilizes a sort of network of players who then in the 30s. But, you know, you could at the same time say it's true of the 30s that for a great many people in 1935, 1936, 1937, who were key figures in the Nazi movement, if you were to tell them then that in 6 years you're going to be presiding over a European-wide genocide,
yeah,
Of Jews involving mass murder, industrial killing,
yeah,
they would not have accepted, yeah, this proposition.
Yeah.
So in that sense, the way in which individuals who are also players who are making things happen, but in the process also sees them adjusting their horizons quite extraordinarily,
right,
and that doesn't mean that you shouldn't look earlier to help understand them, but it does mean that the thing that you're finding earlier is a long, long way removed from, yeah, from the actor in the 1940s.
I think the point that was actually even quite shocking to me, and I think I noted this correctly, was that even Hitler up until 1919, his anti-Semitism was not as strong before that date as it was afterwards.
His politics was quite fluid in the immediate post-war, yeah, period, and surprisingly, he proved as a sort of ordinary soldier, a loyal servant,
yeah,
for the new sort of revolutionary regime. I mean, clearly, yeah, he clearly had absorbed his anti-Semitic ideas, there may be some new findings about to come out, which may sort of reinforce the sense that there was that he had something of an anti-Semitic sort of worldview already before the First World War. But there's no doubt that this crucial period between the end of the war and the summer of 1919, when the terms of the treaty come out, was a defining one for many Germans, and he at that point then becomes this very outspoken,
yeah,
anti-Semitic figure that he had not been before.
I also wanted to ask about a couple of the other articles and book chapters that I'd seen of yours, discussing these concepts of the racial state and the imperial genocide, or I guess the relationship between the kind of geopolitical territorial ambitions to have this empire on the one hand, and the genocide on the other. Maybe I could just ask how the relationship between the genocide and the empire, the Third Reich, was. Let me just ask you how you see these two things as fitting together.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, how long have
you gone? Yeah, I know you've written many, many pages on this, but perhaps just to introduce it for an audience who's unfamiliar.
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly the Nazis had plans to expand the German Empire East. And
yeah,
so living space becomes a core element of Hitler's thinking already in the 1920s, and, you know, absolutely central to Hitler's plans from the moment he comes to power is building up the army, preparing for conflict with Germany's adversaries, and preparing for expansion east. And Hitler's sense of what expansion east should mean is he was very clear that it should not be old-style imperialism, where you had overlords ruling a multiplicity of peoples underneath, that, yeah, actually the new style land policy, as a Bodenpolitik, as he called it, was acquiring land, Germanizing it, yeah. And if any others should be there at all, then it's kind of dispossessed helots who'd be doing some of the slave labor for you.
Yeah.
So that, in its sense, I mean, depending on how you define genocide, it was like sort of settler genocide, in the sense that that you were imagining expunging it. I mean, at the very least, ethnic cleansing, expunging territory of millions of people. So there is a potentially genocidal vision already there from the 1920s. And clearly, once the Nazis movies, they begin the clearing Poles out of parts of Poland that are sort of being re-Germanized. They're also in the bits that rump Poland, there are sort of experimental areas that they're developing as settlement areas. In Ukraine, they're beginning first settlement territories. And none of this gets advanced that far because the war sort of is not won, and so the war has to be won, and then it's not won, and so it never happens. So there's no doubt there is a potentially genocidal imperial vision from the start. How that relates to the Holocaust, of course, is complicated because the notion of clearing Jews starts separately. You want to clear Germany and Austria of its Jews, so in that sense you want to get rid of them, though you're not necessarily initially thinking of killing them. But on the other hand, the notion of land clearance and of getting rid of the populations is intensified once the war starts, and it's in that context that the killings of Jews start. So it's a complex intersection. The Holocaust doesn't originate in these particular imperialist fantasies. The Holocaust is given priority over the others when Jews are killed, when the other major killings of other groups that would probably follow after the war haven't taken place. And yet the Holocaust does take place in these zones where the Nazis are imagining that they'll have their future empire. So they clearly intersect, but the Holocaust is not directly a function of empire, but it's influenced by the imperial visions, and it takes place in those spaces.
The what you mentioned about the the way that Hitler specifically conceived of this empire, in contrast to the old style or old fashioned empires, is it right to say that the Habsburg, the Romanov, the Ottoman empires, they all just, you know, they didn't survive the first war, they collapsed. Does that mean that by the 1920s, that was simply no longer seen as a viable approach, like that was somehow, that kind of empire simply couldn't exist anymore after that date, and that's why it was no longer seen as an option for modern states to try to do that?
Well, I was influenced by the work of the historian Roberta Pergo, with whom I wrote that piece on imperial genocide. One of the things that she says in her book on Mussolini's Nation Empire is that what she draws attention to is how significantly the Versailles Treaty, not so much that, not just the treaty, but the sort of ideas that were around and which the treaty makers and the various different treaties kind of helped give rise to, was that a sense of self-determination, national self-determination, was the legitimate form of statehood now.
I see.
In that sense, there's a feeling that imperial rule over others is it somehow no longer functions as a really secure and stable form of rule. Okay. And so Hitler's notion of expansion is very much in this era of a sense that ethnic homogeneity is the key to creating a sturdy and viable state. So in some ways his vision is imperial because it's expansionist,
right.
And clearly in the Western Europe they were imagining Europe subordinated to German rule, but not absorbed within Germany.
Right.
But in East, his vision really is of what this notion of living space, that it's space that is increasingly cleared of others and great. So yes, I think it you're right. It's a new interwar mood and understanding of what constitutes a stable policy. And Mussolini was also sort of thinking different, also thinking about how to create stable, expanded Italy. The Japanese were doing the same, and in Manchuria, thinking about how to. But of course, the Japanese, they also recognize the old imperial model doesn't work. So they have this notion, partly terrain, which is being Japanified, and partly this sort of pan-Asian sphere, a kind of brotherhood, which where Japan is the dominant element, just as Germans are thinking, well, how can Western Europe be reorganized under Germany? You're trying to find new ways of organizing international relations that recognize hegemony without the sort of undermined claim to legitimacy of the classical empires.
And it seems like that. I think if I understand the seeing it that way helps explain why, well, since the genocide doesn't, by conventional military standards, it doesn't have a conventional logic in the sense of gaining territory or a battlefield logic. It's important to understand Hitler's sense of a kind of settler colonial empire to explain why that happened. Mm. I also wanted to ask about something else. I believe you wrote that when we look at other genocides, that the Holocaust is unique in the scale and sophistication of victims' diaries and chronicles. And you know, I'm just thinking, you know, even here at UT Dallas with the Ackerman Center and at Indiana, that the strength of the survivors' memories and the attention that's been devoted to them by scholars. I guess do you think that this means that as the years go by and the generations go by, you know, 10, 15, 20, 50, 100 years from now, does this, I guess I hope it means that future generations might remember this better than maybe other things that tend to just slip into the past, that this ethical imperative to never forget will, you know, stands a chance of remaining throughout the ages because of this richness of scholarship and memory. That's not really a question, I guess.
I mean, I share with you the hope that that many of these voices are not lost. At the same time, if I look at the way in which the imperative of remembering has been colonized around the world by political leaders who are doing stuff that's shown, to my taste, no evidence of having learned any meaningful lesson from the Holocaust, I do worry that even the slogan "never forget" itself is being turned into something almost meaningless. And actually, so in some ways, we actually have a task ahead of us now, and that task is to sort of reclaim some process of remembering that actually means something.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you see Austrian governments creating monuments in Mali Trostianets to the victims of the Holocaust while embarking on the most ferocious measures against refugees.
Right.
Or in this country, where we have the State Department doing exactly this, erecting exactly the same kind of barriers to migrants fleeing their homelands. fleeing violence in their homelands. Exactly the same kind of tricks, whilst at the same time we remember the St. Louis and look back critically on what we... I mean, so what are we doing when we remember? So in that sense, yes, of course, I share with you the hope, but I actually think that a lot of the never forget has itself become a ritual of, I don't know what, never forget this particular set of actions at this particular time by for this particular... Now, in that sense, it seems to me, I hope we move into something different. Where, I mean, equally, obviously, we're not always going to learn the same lessons. Yeah. People will remember and they'll draw different things from it. And those different things will be meaningful, and it won't stop human beings disagreeing about what they should do. So in that sense, there's never going to be an easy moral imperative. But I think the trick is and will be to sort of keep a balance between the particular and the general. You know, if you're not extrapolating, if you're not saying what we're remembering is not just a group of German Jews on a ship that wasn't allowed to dock and let people off in Havana and then couldn't let people off, but it's actually it's a group of migrants in real distress and other countries not making it their business. So what we will be learning in schools. But the difficulty then is often, well, that's political, you know, because you're then engaging with. So we have to be a little bit braver sometimes, I think, and say, yes, it is political, but, you know, there's no way of, of reading. If we want to learn something from this particular history, there's no way of reading it unpolitically, in the sense it creates certain kind of imperatives to worry about what's happening elsewhere in the world. And if we... And if we're not worried about what's happening elsewhere in the world, then never forget. You might as well forget. You've got nothing. You're learning nothing from it.
Just circling, listening to what you're saying, and circling back to what we discussed a little while ago about your work with the Bund, it makes me think. Well, maybe you know, maybe we should think about how, you know, it's one thing to learn something in school or to you know to go to a museum or you know kind of have a political leader say something. You know, never forget, but you know, again, with what made the Bund able to do what it did was this the way it was a whole way of life, the universal, you know, the body, the physical movement, the friendship, the lectures, the teaching. You know, it was an entire community that that maybe the most important thing is to pay attention to the entire kind of forms of community or ways of life that. That people have, that if it's one thing to just simply read a book about something, but unless one's whole way of life is shaped in this kind of ethical way, that that one will be blind. I mean, I don't know if that's the way.
Yes, I agree with you. I mean, but you know, people have so many different ways of acting. I mean, that you couldn't recreate what the Bund was like now, that the some of the sort of rituals, or I say the hierarchy, I just don't see it working. And I think many people now who are seeking an ethnical kind of community would find much that was restrictive in what they expected, how the individual would subordinate themselves to the group, might even feel somehow inimical with their sense of what it is to live a whole life as an ethical individual. So I think it's fascinating to look at the roots of moral behavior, but we won't simply be able to reproduce it.
Right. Yes. I guess it's a long way between there and here. Finally, if I could just ask, could you maybe tell us a bit about what you're currently working on or current future projects?
the book you mentioned, Lives Reclaimed, has just come out, so I'm still enjoying presenting that, and a German edition is being developed, so I'm working with the translator and the publishers on that, so that's still taking up a little bit of time. I'm excited that I'm the general editor of the Cambridge History of the Holocaust, which will be a four-volume collection of over 100 contributors writing a sort of a big history of where we are in terms of Holocaust research, and that will be the most substantial kind of history of the Holocaust to have been produced for decades. Wow. And so that's going to take up quite a bit of my attention over the next couple of years.
That's very exciting to have that project. Well, our guest today is Dr. Mark Roseman, Pat M. Glaser Chair in Jewish Studies at Indiana University, and author most recently of Lives Reclaimed, A Story of Rescue and Resistance in Nazi Germany. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
And this is the Athenaeum Review podcast. You can find out more at athenaeumreview.org.